From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. It's an all-Wisconsin authors show today, starting with the story of a little-known witness to President Lincoln's death. We'll take a virtual tour of some of hidden Milwaukee. Mona Simpson compares her hometown to the place she calls home now.
No one could. Certainly I couldn't, but I think almost no one could fully understand California, you know, Southern California. There's so many factors in its history. It's so big. It's got so many huge issues. I don't yet, but I feel like I maybe could understand Green Bay.
Plus, a new novel sends young readers to German-occupied Norway at the start of World War II.
The idea that a very powerful force that had been moving across Europe had declared that they were there to protect Norway, neutral Norway, from the Allies. And in the process, they tried to sell that big time.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect for Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. The history of the Civil War is filled with familiar names, military leaders who planned and executed battles, war heroes, and political leaders from the Union and the Confederacy. But the war altered the lives of thousands of otherwise ordinary Americans. James Tanner was a teenager who fought, briefly, in the Civil War and was seriously injured. But it was his career in civil service after the war that was extremely well known at the time, but is almost entirely forgotten today. History writer James Martin believes it's a story worth knowing. His new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. Martin, who is the chair of the history department at Marquette University, spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Teich last month about how his book came to be.
Another book came out a couple of years ago about Civil War veterans in general. And I guess I encountered Tanner first as a caricature. The humor magazine Puck hated Civil War pensions or the abuse of Civil War pensions. And Tanner was kind of the lightning rod for criticism for a long time. And at one point they ran a couple of front page full color cartoons of him. And one of them is of Tanner standing in front of U.S. Treasury with a long cornucopia snaking back into the building. He's got like a Roman toga on, which was interesting because he didn't have two legs. He had lost both legs. And he's just throwing money out to these grasping hands. And that was really the first time I'd heard his name. I saw a few other things too because he was a pretty prominent veteran. And after I finished the bigger book, I'd never done a biography before, and an opportunity came to write this book for a series at the University of Georgia Press, which is meant to be kind of untold stories, shorter books with a good storyline. And so that's how I came across them.
Well, and this seems like it was something of a challenge, at least as you would expect for most people who came of age in the middle of the 19th century. It does not seem that there was a lot of contemporaneous writing about his early life. What do we know about him in the days before the Civil War?
Not very much. I mean, he was very young. He was 16 when the war started. We know that he had more education than most because he was still in school, according to the census, in 1860 when he was would have turned 16 that year.
And this was in upstate New York.
Right, right, west of Albany. And he was a school teacher, at least part-time, and that's about it.
So he joined the Union cause at 16. From your writing, it sounds like what we do know is that his family didn't especially want him to do that.
His father was reluctant for him to go. I don't think – the father seemed to be very supportive of the war effort. But his son was underage, and he had to get his father's permission to go, although he did kind of run away and then came back and got the permission later on. He came from a very democratic part of New York, and so one of the points I make is that he enlists in a regiment that really is being assembled in Brooklyn and New York City, not in Schoharie County. And I think it's because the area is very democratic and not particularly interested in the war for a long time.
His war service was pretty short, pretty uneventful, until the incident that shaped much of the rest of his life.
As far as I can tell, he never fired his gun in anger. He was certainly on campaign several times. He had a little adventure in which he went out into the woods and captured a runaway Confederate or something at one point. That was kind of unclear. But yeah, he sort of witnessed the war without really being a part of it until this day on a hillside and he lost both legs.
What was medical care like for wounded veterans in those days?
As bad as you can imagine it. He had a particularly bad time in that he was captured. This is the Battle of Second Manassas. And it results in a pretty much a rout of the Union Army. And so he's wounded about the time his part of the line is collapsing. He's not even in the line. He's behind the line when he's hurt. They carry him to a sort of a farmhouse that is a makeshift shelter, at least, not really a hospital. And there are 100, 120 other guys there who can't be moved. And so he's actually in Confederate hands for about 10 days with very little care. And so, you know, they dress his legs were amputated below the knee. He is basically unattended. He gets extraordinarily bad bed sores and infection in his back that almost kills him. In fact, the legs don't kill him. The back is much worse.
Right. He describes the darkest time of his life as being when they had to pour basically hydrochloric acid on his back.
Yeah, without any sort of anesthesia. And he gets through, you know, he's in the hospital about 6 weeks after that, after he's exchanged for other Confederates, and goes home and learns how to walk.
He learns how to walk, and he learns a bunch of other stuff, too. How did he go about reintegrating himself into society as the war was winding down?
Well, very quickly. I think by the end of this is early fall 1862 is when he's injured. By early 1863, he's learned stenography or a shorthand.
He basically goes off to business school in Syracuse.
Yeah, exactly. I think he did go there. This was also a correspondence course, but he seemed to actually have attended school in Syracuse. Then he goes back to Washington and gets a job in the War Department. Now, he's kind of back and forth. He also works at Albany during the legislative sessions. He's already kind of getting involved in politics. And as a disabled veteran, he's taking jobs that were reserved for them by middle of the war and afterwards as well.
Well, and the most remarkable story from this part of his life is that he was apparently in the room as President Lincoln died, or so it seems.
Yeah, no one really suggests he wasn't. He lived next door or across the street from Forge Theater. And when the president is shot in April 1865, they carry him across the street to the Peterson House, which is next door to Tanner's apartment. Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, begins taking testimony immediately after the shooting, and they need a stenographer. And somebody in the room knows Tanner lives next door. And again, Tanner's working in the War Department, so there is a network that he's a part of. And he comes over, and from about 10 or 11 that night till about 5 in the morning, he's taking notes in shorthand for the Secretary of War. And as he's finishing up, the small group is gathering around Lincoln's deathbed, and he kind of wanders into the room and watches him die.
And but for the grace of God, would have been able to write down exactly Lincoln's last words. But it turns out
it was the chaplain's last words, actually. But his pencil was broken, so he couldn't do it. He does correct. Stanton has a very famous, "Now he belongs to the ages," line that he says. And for a time, it was thought he said, "Now he belongs to the angels." But Tanner, no one knew Tanner was there until he became famous. And he really didn't make much of it until he was famous. And so
he's actually airbrushed out of all the images,
exactly, yeah,
if you will.
And a lot of people are brushed into the images as well. But some of the sketches seem to be accurate in terms of who's there, and he's not. But he corrects this longstanding mistake. His notes are kind of a famous document the Union League Club in Philadelphia has now. And as people were dying off, they commemorate Lincoln's assassination. So this is the second and last person who was in the room when Lincoln died. When he was the last one, it was actually Robert Lincoln, Lincoln's son, and Tanner were the last two. They were about the same age, I suppose.
Right, in their early 20s.
Yeah, yeah.
So Tanner takes up law. He settles in Brooklyn for a time. How does he end up connected to national politics besides, you know, having been sort of around them in Washington during the war?
Well, he joins the Grand Army of the Republic, which is the sort of the American Legion for Civil War soldiers. He is clearly quite political from the very beginning because he's never not involved. I mentioned earlier that he's working for the legislature on and off. You know, as he's reading for the law back in Schoharie, he is quite a speaker. He's a gregarious guy. He likes to be in politics. And then he starts having – he has a job in the Customs House. Then he's the tax collector for Brooklyn, which are very – they're appointed positions, but they're very political. And that's his entree, I think, into it. So as a veteran, as a Republican, he's sort of at the right time and place.
Well, and he winds up getting a pretty plum job in the Harrison administration, Pension Commissioner of the United States.
Which is one of the biggest jobs in the government at the time.
Well, and so what was that? This is not a job that exists today in exactly this way. What was that job responsible for?
all of the pensions being given out to veterans and their widows and orphans and other family members. This is 1889 is when he's appointed to this position. By this time, pensions are the single largest item in the federal budget, and they'll stay that way for quite a while. He has thousands of employees that he's responsible for, a massive operating budget. They give out $40 million a year or so in pensions.
Which was a lot of money in those days.
A lot of money. It's a lot of money now, I think, but it was a lot of money for the federal government then. There's a brand new building. He's sort of in charge of which is now the National Building Museum.
It's a beautiful building.
It's gorgeous, red brick building. And it's a massive job. It's not quite cabinet level. He doesn't have anything to do with policymaking otherwise, but it's a bigger job than most cabinet level positions.
And he was not what you would call an unqualified success in that job, was he?
He was not. He's fired for 6 months. He resigns, but he's fired. He gets into tiffs with the Secretary of the Interior is his boss at the time. And over appointments, he kind of cleans out a lot of the former Democratic administrators. He has a very generous pension policy, including re-rating, they called them. So people already getting pensions could apply to have a higher pension if their condition worsened. He actually got his re-rated several times because of his legs. And no one ever really suggested he personally was corrupt, but there seemed to be corruption or at least abuse within the system. This is a chronic thing that opponents complain about for many years, but he became a scapegoat for it.
Well, and how would you compare the debate over pensions for war veterans to the current state of affairs regarding the VA?
Well, that's a really good point. I mean, I'll mention a difference right now. Opponents of pensions would focus on the fact that many of the men getting pensions probably didn't deserve them. Either they had not really served hard, had hard service. They were coffee coolers and, as they were called, behind-the-lines guys who had gotten sick since the war. And in fact, the pension law was changed several times. Early on, you had to prove that your disability was a direct result of your war service. By 1889 or so, it was you just had to be a disabled soldier. And eventually, old age could become a disability. And so 500,000 men are on the pension by the 1890s. That seemed excessive to opponents. And the Democratic Party tended to be the party that opposed them. And they really took it out on the soldiers. And so the things they would say about the veterans and the things they would say with the GAR associating with veterans that were somehow abusing their rights and this privilege were pretty incredible. And you will never hear that today talking about veterans.
Well, James Martin, thank you so much for sharing this story, and hopefully it'll spur some interest in other stories like his.
Well, thank you very much.
James Martin's new book is called America's Corporal, James Tanner in War and Peace. It's published by the University of Georgia Press. Martin, who's chair of the History Department at Marquette University, first spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke last month. Stay tuned. Up next, we'll discover some places in Milwaukee that aren't immediately apparent. Bobby Tanzillo takes us on a tour of hidden Milwaukee when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. It's an all-Wisconsin authors edition of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The line goes something like this. It was midnight in the city that keeps its secrets. Well, like all cities, there are quite a few out-of-the-way and forgotten corners of Milwaukee. Some are hidden in plain sight. Others take a bit of sleuthing. And as Bobby Tanzillo found out, some of them require no fear of spiders, heights, or closed spaces to access. By day, Tanzillo is the managing editor of OnMilwaukee.com, but his passion may just be exploring all of the places in town you never thought you could get to. And his new book, Hidden History of Milwaukee, showcases a number of them. He joined me in the studio last month. Bobby, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Bonnie. It's great to be here.
Hidden History of Milwaukee. This is a great book because I sat down and learned so much about Milwaukee. And one of the things I learned was that it seemed like doing this book involved you either climbing up very, very tall things or going very, very deep into the ground most of the time.
Yes, not always. You know, what I liked about doing it was that, like you reading it, I was learning about Milwaukee as I went. I mean, I sort of went to these places with no – I shouldn't say no preconceived notions, but I guess my preconceived notions were like everybody else. You go past this place. It's nice. It's a landmark. And you move on. Keep going. And I just decided kind of spur of the moment to call this place or call that place and say, can I come see it? And there was always a story to be had, you know, when you go to these places, and often a story I had no idea existed. In some cases, like Lake Emily under Northwestern Mutual, I went because I wanted to see what could be seen of this lake or retention pond or whatever it technically was there on the site, because I knew a little bit about that story. But even when I went there, I found out all kinds of things I didn't know, like this thing they call Little Egypt, which is an old sort of grand staircase that's still there, but now it's underground. You walk in there and you go into this big open space, and here's this beautiful staircase, and there's nobody there, and it's dark.
And how far underground are you at that point?
Maybe the grade is about maybe 18 to 20 feet above your head.
So Lake Emily is underneath the Northwestern Mutual main building. Is that correct?
Yes. And I think – and a little bit behind it, but that doesn't really matter so much anymore, you know, because there had been a building, an addition put on behind it that's no longer there, although the basement is still there. The basement of that building is still there.
And they still use it.
Yes.
One of the things that, of course, I didn't even think about until I was reading the book was that when Wisconsin Avenue was actually like a tributary into the lake.
Yeah, right.
And so that Lake Emily, which whatever – whether it's a pond or whatever – existed long before we were building in Milwaukee.
Right. Yeah, it was basically a place that sort of filled up, I think, when it rained. Do you know what I mean? I think there was always water there from what I can tell, but it never seemed like it got super deep.
So it wasn't like there was water all the time, but
no,
it
but
would
people
fill
remember
up.
Like people remember, you know, you can find memoirs where people talk about having gone swimming there and things. So it was deep enough to do that at times, you know. But I'm not sure it was technically a lake. You know,
okay.
There seems to be a lot of discussion about, if you go back and look at different sources, about whether or not it was actually a lake or just a retention pond, sort of like a natural kind of collecting place for water.
Awfully close to Lake Michigan to be another lake.
Yeah. And if you look at – there's a painting that used to – when I worked at the Sentinel, it hung in the Sentinel newsroom. But now it's at the County Historical Society, I believe. And it's a painting that shows Wisconsin Avenue – at that time, and you can see Wisconsin Avenue where the roadbed is now was sort of a gully, and water would run down and then run from there into the lake. And this was sort of right adjacent to that. So I think it was all part of that kind of natural system of runoff there.
It sounded like you had to get quite a lot of permission to get down as far down as you got to go, although not quite to the lake.
No, not quite to the lake, although I think I got as close to the lake as anybody can get. That's what they said. We went in the basement. And, you know, they open these – they have these holes in the ground, and they can open them, and you look down, and you can see a little bit of water. And if you can see water, everything's good, because the water has to be there to prevent the pilings, the wooden pilings that hold the building up, from rotting away. So then I thought that was as close as we can get. But then the guy who took me around said, oh, there's one more place we can go. And he opened a hatch in the floor, and he said, after you. And, you know, when somebody opens a hatch in the floor, I go in. So – we went down, and that's a sub-basement that you can't even – we couldn't stand up in it. We had to sort of bend maybe three quarters. And then that's as close as you can get. So there you're about 4 feet closer to it. So at that point, you're maybe 4 feet above the actual waterline.
The book is full of places around Milwaukee that are like this. But let's go – unfortunately, we're staying still on Wisconsin Avenue with this, and I want to get out of like downtown, but this is like an iconic thing, which is the gaslight.
Oh, that – which was fun.
And so this is
– really fun.
From going all the way down underneath, now you're all the way to the top, or
yeah.
Could you get to the top?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The hardest part about that was climbing through the spider webs to get to the
– I have to say you're braver than I.
Because they had spiders in them. You know, otherwise I wouldn't really mind. In the lobby of that building, it's like walking into – almost like walking into the Empire State Building or Rockefeller Center. The lobby in there is a beautiful Art Deco lobby, which is really nice. But then you can go up to the top and you can go out onto the roof, and then you climb up the platform that the flame is on. And then the best part is you can kind of stick your head in the flame.
Can you really?
Yeah. It's just a big – I'm not sure if it's glass or – I think it was plastic. you can kind of stick your head in there and see the lights in there. So it's great that it's still there, and I know they're working on trying to get it to be lit up a little more often than it is now.
Right. You said something about LEDs, trying to change it over to LEDs.
Yeah, I think it's a budgetary
thing.
It's expensive to keep light bulbs running in there all the time.
So you've gone to the Heights, and I know there were a few other things, like you went to the top of St. Jehoshaphat.
Yes, which was really one of the first things I did that kind of got me interested in doing this. Not long before that, I went with Molly Snyder at On Milwaukee. All of these, by the way, I wrote for onmilwaukee.com, where I'm the managing editor, and I get to do these things because I work at the place that lets me do all these things, you know. I work with Molly, and she got the opportunity to go to the top of the Allen Bradley Clock Tower. And I always wanted to go up. I heard there was like a room up there that they use as a party room, and we got to do that, but we also got to go outside all the way at the top at the base of the flagpole. And that's just exhilarating. The wind is blowing. It's a beautiful day. So when we got asked about going up to the top of St. Josephat, I said, sure, you know, let's do this. And they made me sign a waiver. And, you know, usually when I've signed waivers, I've thought, well, why did they make me sign that? You know, but here you're climbing up these wooden ladders that were built for workmen when they built the dome. And they go sort of straight up in 12 feet into darkness. You don't know where you're going. You get up there, and then there's another one. And you end up crawling across the dome on a sort of – this sort of a ladder, but it's – you know, it follows the curve of the dome. So you're on all fours really going up this ladder. And you get to the top, and there's that oculus that is just open. There's nothing covering it that goes straight down to the floor of the sanctuary of the church. So that's a little
– quite a far
creepy.
Way
and
down.
And then you can keep going up. And so when I did that one, I thought – that's the kind of place they really want you to sign a waiver, and they're smart to do that. But that it became addictive to me then. I really just, you know, after that, I got a chance to go up to City Hall, and then I did the City Hall thing, and the art museum said, oh, you got to come up and come out on the wings. And so I did that, and one thing just would sort of lead to another.
As you said, these were all columns at On Milwaukee. And so how long did it take you to have all these adventures so that you could put them into a book?
I think I have been doing a maybe – about 2 years now.
Okay.
Probably about 2 years. And they keep coming. There's been a bunch since the book. And every now, you know, now and then I write one and I think, oh, I wish I would have had time. I would have been able to get that done.
Have to do a second book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There is one in here that I really like because it's not really about a building. And that's the rare book room.
Oh, at the library.
At the library.
Which also has the great architectural archive on the same floor. The stuff they have there is just incredible. And what's really nice about it now, though, is some of the things in the book people can't really do. They're not open to the public. But the rare books room, although it's not open for walk-ins, you can make an appointment and you can go look at anything in there. These things belong to us, you know. There are just some incredible treasures in there. And the librarians who are in charge of that collection are super passionate about it. And the most amazing thing is this book, this huge oversized book that they put together to raise money to build one of the statues that's out in the Court of Honor in front of the library there. And Captain Pabst ended up buying the book, you know, to raise money for this thing. But this book has just hundreds and hundreds of handwritten messages and signatures from all kinds of famous people of the era. There's presidents, there's musicians, John Philip Sousa, there's Mark Twain.
Oh, this is the autograph book.
This is the autograph
book.
Yeah. And it's incredible because, like, Twain wrote a few lines, a verse, and the artists would sign their name, but then they'd make a little sketch next to it. And it's really just an incredible, incredible thing.
Well, as you said, a lot of the things that you did, most of us aren't going to be able to do. You got special permission. Of the things that people can do other than the library, what would you recommend from the book?
You can take a tour of the bell tower of City Hall. People can do that. You can just go to City Hall, and I don't know if they do it on the spot or if you have to make an appointment, but that's a great thing to do because usually they'll let you ring the bell too.
Oh, cool.
Which is nice. And now our office is now across the street from City Hall. And at random times during the day, I'll hear the bell ringing and I'll say, somebody's getting a tour.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can do that. And that's incredible. With all due respect to the Art Museum, that's really the icon of Milwaukee architecture, I think. That's until the Art Museum was built, that was the building everybody, thanks to Laverne and Shirley maybe, that everybody associated with Milwaukee.
So, and it's a beautiful building.
Oh, and it's a beautiful building. And what's great about it is the first place you go when you go on that tour is you go – the first steps that go up to the top are an old apartment. A caretaker lived in that bell tower, and at least one kid was raised up there who later got a job for the city. I mentioned it in the
Very film. Cool. That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is there anything else that's public? Because I'm assuming that people are going to read this and go, God, I want to go see that.
Well, you know, actually, a number of these things, you could go Wisconsin Club. You can go to the Wisconsin Club and eat usually. And
that's an amazing building too, and certainly the domes.
And the domes. You can, of course, see the art museum, but you can't go to the top. The World's Fair Pavilion that Pabst built for Chicago in 1893 is the entry to the Pabst Mansion now. So you can't go to the Pabst Mansion without going through it. So you have to. That's one you definitely can go to. Some places, like, you know, some of the churches I wrote about, St. Paul's, you can go in, you know, and if they're closed, usually there's somebody there that'll let you in and look.
Well, Bobby, it has been great having you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Bonnie.
When he isn't finding hidden parts of Milwaukee to scale, climb, or dive into, Bobby Tanzillo is the managing editor of OnMilwaukee.com. His book, Hidden History of Milwaukee, is published by the History Press, and we first spoke with him last month. We'll take another break now, and then we'll continue our All Wisconsin Authors show with acclaimed novelist and Green Bay native Mona Simpson about her latest book and the thoughts of her hometown. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with an all-Wisconsin authors edition of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North, and it's great to have your company. When you're a kid, a lot of the world seems like a mystery in need of figuring out. And probably the most obvious example of that is figuring out your parents. That's what Miles Adler Hart sets out to do from a pretty young age. He's the fictional hero of Green Bay native Mona Simpson's latest novel, Casebook. Miles goes so far as to employ investigative techniques to snoop on his mother as she and his father divorce, and she starts dating the mysterious Eli. Over the years that the book covers, Miles not only learns about the inner workings of adulthood, he begins to understand more about himself. Mona Simpson, whose other books include the well-regarded Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road, was back in Wisconsin recently, and she stopped by our studio to talk with Mitch Tyke, who wondered if mother-son relationships are explored enough in literature.
I suppose I can think of some if I really put my mind to it. It's funny. It's something I haven't actually thought about. I'm thinking, when you first say that, I'm thinking of this great scene, I guess, in War and Peace, where the mother of the hero is quite desperate to get the money for his education. I think she's a poor widow, and she goes to ask her wealthy friend to borrow money for his education. And that's one. Of course, that's a grown son and
sure.
a grown mother. But I guess you're probably asking that since I've written a book about a mother and a son.
Well, yeah, exactly. And as I thought about many of the books that I've read, certainly in recent years, there's a lot of mother-daughter relationships that are portrayed. But it's rare to consider how a mother and son affect each other.
I think that's true. Now that I think of it, I hadn't actually thought of that before. But I think it's interesting to write about kind of the way we live now with the family. So in this case, it's a divorced mom and a son who has little sisters, so he's sort of the man of the family, which I think is a kind of a new iteration a little bit and has its own complexity.
Well, and you say it's the something to the way we live now, and I got to thinking this is set in Southern California, and I wonder if there's something – you know, you grew up in Wisconsin, but you now live in California. It's hard for me to imagine this book being set in Wisconsin. Is this a California novel?
I don't think so. I think this book could be set in Wisconsin. I mean, the sort of central themes of sort of spying on one's parents and wanting to protect one's parent and not being able to, especially in a case of divorce, that happens here too.
Well, certainly, yeah. And maybe it's just there's certain specifics to the setting that feel
right.
very California.
Yes,
certainly they feel foreign to Wisconsin.
Yes, it's definitely set in L.A.
The issue that comes up repeatedly in conversations between Miles, who's your protagonist, and his best friend Hector, who's kind of a secondary protagonist, if you will, is this idea of whether they are happier with their parents apart. And that is that's a question that I remember asking myself a lot when my parents divorced. Is that a question you've turned over in your head a good deal?
You know, it's funny. It's a funny thing about writing books, but you find yourself learning – I wouldn't have actually said that if you'd asked me that 5 years ago before I wrote this book. And yet I grew up with divorced parents and I probably did have it, exactly that thought. Although in my case, I don't really remember my parents together. They divorced when I was quite young. But I think it is a sort of question. And I think it's also, in a funny way, I think it's a typical question of divorced children, because one of the things about divorce, if you're the child, is how little power you have in it. And it's a way of trying to think whether or not you would rather they'd be back together or not, is a way of almost assuming that you do have some control in a situation where really you don't.
Well, and it strikes me that Miles, who's kind of – he's narrating this in retrospect, but he's really growing up as the novel progresses.
Right.
And he seems like he's kind of coming to terms with understanding his own power.
Right. And how much of it he has and how much of it he doesn't have.
There's a lot made of the phenomenon of the unreliable narrator in fiction. But I was thinking about Miles as the narrator, and I wonder if he could be anything but unreliable in a way, because he's sort of in this position where he doesn't have a lot of power and he only has access to a certain part of really what's his own story.
Right. I think that's certainly true, although he's trying to be reliable, which makes a difference. you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And it strikes me one of the real – what you've really managed to pull off in this book is that as he gets older, he gets somewhat more reliable.
Yeah.
As though his memory – you know, it's not that it failed him, but he only understood a certain number of things
right.
when he was 9 or 10.
Right. And at moments, I think the reader even understands a little bit more than he does.
How challenging was it for you to channel a teenage boy, a growing teenage boy, as a narrator?
Well, it felt kind of natural to me, perhaps because I've lived with one for a while. I'm not sure he thought that it was also so pitch perfect. So I had some of my male students read it to sort of get an external vantage. I think it was – I like channeling people – for whatever reason, who have some kind of interesting new take on vernacular English. But also for me, for this story, I don't know quite else how it didn't really start moving until I had that vantage.
Well, and so did the story start with Miles for you?
Well, I wanted to tell a love story, and it's embedded in this story. And I sort of started noodling around with it, but it didn't really start moving and come to life until I hit on Miles's investigation of it.
And it's interesting because, well, I should just ask you, you think of it as a love story. Do you also think of it as a mystery or
I
is
do.
It,
yeah. I think of it as sort of both. I mean, a mystery in the sense of, you know, there's no great crime. Some people would say there's a crime, but there's not a prosecutable crime in it. So it's a mystery story applied to the emotional and moral dimensions rather than the criminal.
A mystery in so much as people figuring out the world around them is kind of a continual mystery. I mean,
I
think about your adults who are certainly the Mims is a mathematician and this speaks to mystery in itself as well.
Yeah.
Was there a central question that you wanted to address as Miles came to you?
I wanted to kind of talk about romantic love and whether it was, I guess you could say, a good idea. And I wanted these kids to be sort of pondering that as they grow up and trying to figure out whether that should have a place in their life or whether there are other more reliable, more accountable kinds of affection that ought to take priority.
I wonder if there's something more organic about kids asking these questions than adults who have already perhaps have their formed opinions about, you know, whether romantic love is worth it or not.
Right. I think there is something to that. And also, Miles has a natural sort of suspicion, and he and his friend are very suspicious. And yet they're quite innocent, really, in terms of their own feelings. Like, and when something goes wrong, he doesn't have the sort of collection of received assumptions or received ideas of people get over things and, you know, no one dies of love. No, he doesn't have any of those ideas. So he's ready to scream. He's got a kind of raw pain and he'll feel it.
And it's interesting because we think today of teenagers as being a really kind of sexualized bunch. But
not these two.
Yeah, they are both sort of intrigued and also repelled by the idea of sex.
They are, and they're also kind of, I guess you could call them nerds. They're kind of on the outskirts of the mainstream social life of their school. They're not completely out of it, but they're definitely not really mingling in it so much. They occasionally try to, and at moments they get a little close, but they're still in that phase where the most important person really in each other's life is each other. And it's interesting for Miles because he is attracted to girls, and there's one girl in particular he has romantic feelings about, but he realizes that she's not nearly as important to him really as Hector, who he essentially collaborates with about everything, all his major projects in life.
And he and Hector are both from homes where the parents have split up, and it strikes me that neither of them has a particularly good model to work from. Miles' mom is in this furtive relationship with Eli, who, you know, as things play out, is a little mysterious, exactly. And it's certainly not something that he would base a romantic relationship on in watching his mom and Eli, or even thinking
and
back on his mom and dad.
His dad is getting letters under the door from who knows who. although Hector's parents do begin to find other people.
What should we make of the fact that Miles doesn't call his mom mom? He refers to her as the Mims, and he refers to his sisters as the Boops.
He's just got a – he feels he has sort of a little bit of a take on family life. I think he's not quite to the point of calling his mother by her name, but he doesn't want to call her mom. He feels too grown up for that.
Let me ask you just a little bit about Kraft. When you conceived of Miles, did you already in your head know where he was and where he was going?
I didn't exactly know where he was at the end. I knew the age he was, and I knew some of the experiences he'd had. The whole business with college and all and what happens with that, I kind of figured that out as I went along.
And you didn't need to have that planned out before you started?
Well, the way I usually do it is I write a draft and then I revise it many, many, many times. So in a way, that's a kind of – some people outline, some people write a draft. It almost serves the same purpose.
The draft is the outline in this case.
Or I tinker with it there. From there, I make the changes.
I'm curious to have you think back on your time in Green Bay because you are back in Wisconsin, and – as a writer who deals a lot in setting, I'm curious how you see Wisconsin and your trips. I don't know whether you think of it as home still versus the Green Bay you knew.
You know, I kind of do and I don't. And it's interesting. I was just home in Green Bay mainly to see family and to see two people. One is my mom's very close friend who's 83 and one is a woman who's 95. But actually, I came back to Wisconsin, oh gosh, a little more than a year ago, last spring for a family funeral. And when I was there, it did strike me that I wanted to write more about Green Bay.
Mona Simpson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Green Bay native Mona Simpson is the author of such well-known books as Anywhere But Here and Off Keck Road. Her latest novel is Casebook, which came out in April. She stopped by the Lake of X studio on a recent trip back to Wisconsin to visit family and friends, and she spoke then with Mitch Tyke. We'll take one last break and then talk about a new novel from a Milwaukee-area writer that takes young readers to Norway during the German occupation of World War II. We'll hear about that in a moment on an all-Wisconsin author's edition of Lake Effect on WUWM.
An All Wisconsin Authors edition of Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Life in a war zone is obviously not an easy situation, but to grow up in such a setting is an even more daunting challenge. Milwaukee area writer Sandy Brail's new middle grade novel tells a coming-of-age tale set in occupied Norway at the start of World War II. Odin's Promise relates the story of Mari, who finds herself growing up and learning about her inner resources as German soldiers patrol the streets of her Norwegian village. Brail joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio to talk about the book and what piqued her interest in the Norwegian resistance.
I'm not Norwegian to begin with. I have a good friend who is the only child of a Norwegian immigrant and has no relatives at all in this area and wanted to travel back to Norway to meet the people that she already had met in the old days through mail, and needed someone to travel with, and it was the best decision I ever made. And on that original trip many years ago, most of her relatives of her generation or older had lived through World War II and the occupation for those long years. And the pictures they showed and the stories they told, I was a writer then, and I knew there had to be something I could do with this. So that was the origin of it.
So that difficult chapter in Norwegian history sounds like it is still alive today over there.
It is. And in fact, the research that I've done over all these years has and I'm continuing to do now has revealed that it was something that almost developed a mystique, the extent to which both the organized resistance, the military, and the secret communications and almost a spy network were organized have been documented somewhat in movies and in various books. But the day-to-day resistance of people that helped them survive the extremely harsh conditions was not covered as thoroughly, and that really is what kept communities going. And many of those same people had roles in the other aspects of the resistance as well. But virtually every family was involved, and the mystique surrounding that has never faded.
And Odin's Promise is not a true story, but clearly there are many portions of it that are informed by real-life events.
Absolutely. I had started the research, and then in the process of attempting many versions of writing it, got stalled at every point trying to tell the original story that centered around the wedding that had appealed to me. And along the way, over many years, the advice was this really should be like this whole genre should be a middle grade story. And my characters weren't young people, and I wanted to tell it my way. So despite the fact that I was learning a lot about writing, I was not doing as well as I should have learned to do about taking good advice from knowledgeable people who also write for that age range and said, there's something here you could work on.
Why did they think middle grade fiction was the right genre for this?
Well, my original thought was, if you've ever seen Jan Brett's illustrated picture books, was when I heard the story, this would make such a fabulous picture book for the scenery and the customs and the costumes and everything else. And I used picture books with older readers and thought this would be great. But over the course of time, picture books have changed so radically. If picture books are for older readers now, they are almost entirely more information-based than just the history of this. And for younger readers, the characters were too old, the story was too complex, and so they were looking at aiming up. And in the process of that, it just was perfectly clear that the characters were all adults. If you were going to do anything with it for kids, you needed to, which is what I wanted to do, something that could be read in schools. Along the lines of Snow Treasure by Maria McSwiggan, and that which is just a perennial favorite, and others that had been – that I had used with my students. So
you clearly – you introduced a younger character, and you basically tell this story through the eyes of Mari, who mm-hmm. is a middle grade girl herself in this
mm-hmm.
time.
Yes. But I couldn't find her through all the reason I kept saying no was she wasn't anywhere in my head, and it was the research that brought her to me. A doctoral presentation by someone who is a specialist in Norwegian history and language happened to be published by the University of Wisconsin Press, in fact. And in digging around, I found that, and she had documented journals of people who had lived through those long years, many of whom were adults, but quite a few of whom were really young people. And keeping a journal was at risk to your life as well because there were raids on homes and everything was searched. And so the young people who had done it really offered me a voice that let me discover their point of view.
And so this essentially becomes both a chronicle of this year in her life and year in the life of this town, but it's also something of a coming of age story. I mean, she is growing from a little girl or little one, as she's referred to, into someone who really can play a role in the way things are going in this community.
And surprises herself in the process. The reality that was just beyond her comprehension whatsoever that was confronting her helped her discover things in herself that she didn't realize were there. And she came to some of that self through the partnership with her dog when she had been left to her own devices as her older siblings and parents were busy with more mature lives. So I think she was ready for it when it happened and found that in herself.
And we don't want to give away too many of the twists and turns, but give us a flavor for what life was like in this small village during the German occupation.
Well, this is only the first year, and it continued for many, and things got much, much, much harsher. But in that first year, the invasion occupation was really very similar to the events that we're hearing about in Ukraine and Crimea. The idea that a very powerful force that had been moving across Europe had declared that they were there to protect Norway, neutral Norway, from the Allies. And in the process, they tried to sell that big time.
Propaganda war in many ways.
Oh, totally. And that another thing in this research by Dr. Stoker, she shows many archival posters, and that plays a role in the story too. Posters were up constantly saying Norwegians and Germans are brothers in their genetic making, in fact. So that was hard to hear too because nobody – there were some who supported the Germans, whether out of belief or because of being having an easier life in the process.
You got more rations.
Absolutely. It was definitely – and benefits with jobs. In that first year already, there were people who lost their jobs. The effects on Jews – and Norway didn't have a large Jewish population, but the effects on the Jewish population were already coming into play. And within a year forward of that, they were – gathered up and exported. And the need for ration cards, the need for secrecy was a major part of it, and not knowing who you could trust, which is truly probably the most challenging part that Mari dealt with and that everyone had to deal with.
Even in a place like school where she has friends that she's not sure how much she should share with them.
Right. It's one of the first hard lessons she had to learn from her family was you can't believe what you see on the surface, that what no matter what someone says or what you've known about them before, one of the expressions they used was they might be striped, which would mean that depending on who they were facing, they could present the face that would benefit them most. And some kids might have been opposed to the German occupation but had a parent who was going to take what they chatted about at the table and benefit from it.
Why did you choose a smaller town versus setting this somewhere like Oslo or Bergen or Stavanger?
Well, in part because Itre Arne is where I visited, and that's where her family is from. And the setting and not only the physical setting but the community that was there and wrapped itself around the fjord and the size of the community allowed me to find those characters much more readily. In fact, it's such a terrific place because it is so closely related to Bergen and the train connections. People commute through the train, right, to go over to Bergen. So it allowed me to reflect some things related to why the presence would be so great there because the Germans didn't occupy every little village and knoll equally, but the access to the fjord, which is actually one of the longest and deepest in Norway and is still used for submarine maneuvers. It's so deep. And all of those things are part of why the Germans were desperately eager to maintain total control of Norway to begin with and the fact that Bergen and its port was right across the mountain.
Mari and her family have several encounters with some of the occupying soldiers. And again, we don't want to give much away, but you portray them with some nuance. Some of the German soldiers are truly bad or evil, but others less so. Why did you want to make sure you made some of the German soldiers have some redeeming value to them?
Well, I've thought about that a great deal because it didn't start out with a conscious effort to do that. But that process, too, probably reflects decades of my life in that my father was the son of immigrants from Germany and went to fight in World War II on German soil, which had to have been the most conflicting thing possible, although he, like the rest of that generation, really resisted discussing those things at all until they were quite elderly, and then we lost some of that. So I knew there could be an internal conflict in a soldier, but then I also have lived, as we all have, through more than a decade of ongoing war. And you hear those same stories coming back from our soldiers and recognize that some, I do think, American or not, have had some evil elements to them. The things they've done have been considered atrocities and should be. But others have found in themselves through the process the conflict they feel in wanting to defend us and yet – or be loyal. And there can be other reasons too. How many people join the military because they need the financial security of it? And in Germany, there wasn't much choice. They recruited anyone who had a pulse.
What do you hope your young readers come away with when they finish this book?
Well, first of all, I hope they find themselves doing what I always did as an avid reader, which is just fall into the book. I hope I've written a story that is strong enough that despite it not being a familiar one or something characters and using some language from Norway and situations that they might not recognize, especially the small village, that they nevertheless feel they've been there and they've known her and they care about her. And that's number one for any writer. If I can do that, I can walk away. But on top of that, I really hope it opens the door to them to be able to view things with the same kind of full open mind, to recognize that situations aren't black and white and that no matter what age you are, what I often inscribe for young people is that you are stronger than you think you are. You're always stronger than you think you are. And the question is whether or not you can find that strength.
Sandy Braille, thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much. It's been an honor and a privilege to be here, and I enjoyed it very much.
Likewise.
Milwaukee area writer Sandy Braille's new middle grade novel is called Odin's Promise. It's published by Crispin Books. She first spoke with Mitch Tyke last month. And that wraps up our All Wisconsin Authors edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North, thanking you again, as always, for tuning in today. We're looking forward to having you join us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.